It's been a long and kind of strange election season, so we thought we'd bring in Susan Monty to cut through some of the clutter. The former Democratic statewide official joins us next on another edition of Politically Speaking.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say. Hands to kiss and babies to shake.
But I think my record speaks for itself.
That's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio, she's back from Jefferson City, folks.
Yes, Joe Manis.
And joining us from the beautiful and historic metropolis of St. Joseph, Missouri, we have as our very special guest today,
Susan Monty.
Former state auditor, former Buchanan County auditor.
Yeah. Former state Democratic Party chairman.
That's right.
So you're
former city council person.
So the reason we invited the former auditor Monty on the show is we had a previous podcast with former treasurer Sarah Steelman, and we thought it would be a good chance to step back a little bit, have somebody on the show who's been there before, who's not in it right now. So
right.
Sometimes those types of guests are actually some of our best guests because they're not running for anything, so they're a little bit more freewheeling. So
yeah, and please feel free to go to our website, and under the Politically Speaking little thing, you can find the Steelman podcast, which is actually quite good.
Yeah, and but enough nostalgia for now. Tell us a little bit about yourself for people who may not have followed your political career or professional career.
Well, I am from St. Joseph, so I'm living back at home now. It's so funny when I think about it as a political career, because I never actually intended on being in politics myself, except as an activist and a volunteer. I always thought that my husband was going to run for office, and I was training to be the support person or something. But I actually ran for a city council spot in St. Joseph. I moved back there, and I think I was, in my 40s. And I ran for a city council spot because I was angry about something. We had one city councilwoman, or one city council member who was a woman, and she got bullied and pushed around and resigned. And I just kind of decided that they needed a little more stronger stuff on the city council. And I did that without ever thinking of running for anything else. And then because I was unhappy about the way our county auditor got replaced. And at the time, county auditor in Buchanan was the place where everyone went to die. We had all of our auditors died in office because they were former something else that then got appointed to the auditor's office. And I was chair of the county there, and when we went to look at the county auditor's office, we figured out that we weren't computerized. This would have been in 1999.
You would be surprised, but in a lot of counties in Missouri in like the 2000s, they were not technologically savvy. I remember there was a situation like Howard County, for example, where the clerk resigned for some reason and the new person found that it was just a mess. So sure it's very similar even in larger counties like Buchanan, for example.
Well, we were handwriting our checks, and I know that because I was set to take office on January 1st, and on New Year's Eve, they called me after I had gotten elected. And they said, "Oh my gosh, we have our checks all set with the old auditor signature electronically on them, and so it won't be any good tomorrow. So you need to come in and hand sign all of the paychecks."
Oh,
so that was my first duty as county auditor, and I ran for that just primarily because of that. I thought that it needed to be automated. And yes, you're right about all these other counties, because when I became state auditor, of course, I had to audit all the counties in the state. And so I know how prevalent it was. And my outrage was probably a little misplaced, because Buchanan County was a little better off than some of the other counties. So.
Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things for our listeners to know about Susan Monty is that you're a lawyer and a CPA.
Yes.
And that was a big deal when you were first running. And actually, it was a pretty hot contest, your very first bid in 2006. And anyway, so you won. And then in 2010, which happened to be kind of a dark year for Democrats.
An ugly year.
Ugly is pretty good. You were challenged by Tom Schweik. Mm-hmm. And got to be somewhat of a nasty contest, not so much.
Really, it was more nasty on the Republican primary side between Alan Isen and Tom Schweik than it was between you two. That was my perception.
Well,
I could be wrong.
I thought it got a little nasty at the end. I covered your one debate at the Lake of the Ozarks. I remember that one very clearly. But what's intriguing to me is what happened that year. The general assumption had been, because this was 2010, off year, no president. Democrats often don't do that great in Missouri in off years because their people don't come out. Republicans tend to be more reliable voters. And the bottom line is that Robin Carnahan, who was running for the U.S. Senate against Roy Blunt, this was his first bid for Senate. She was Secretary of State making her first bid for the Senate. She had been favored a year and a half ago, but by the summer of 2010, she was not in good political shape. And the bottom line was she ended up losing by Blunt that fall by about 14 percentage points.
That's right.
And you had been considered likely to win re-election, but you ended up losing to Schweik by 5. And your loss was one of the first cases of a down ballot incumbent losing in like decades. But the reason I'm bringing all this up is because now we're in a presidential election year, and there are many people who talk about the trickle down. I mean, in 2012, many believe that Claire McCaskill's contest against Todd Akin ended up changing the trickle down, so it wasn't from the presidential contest, it was from her contest, and it helped Democrats below. When you look back, I mean, I was interested in you talking about that. I mean, when you knew that you were losing, because you were considered to be winning till about a month out, and just kind of what the effect that has if there's a race above you that ends up being a blowout.
Right, and that is exactly what happened. And it was, I mean, we could see it coming. We knew, because at some point, it was very clear that no national money was going to come in to Robin Carnahan's Senate race. There's a whole separate dialogue we can have as to why the Democrats don't have an infrastructure for getting out the vote anymore, and that stems back quite a ways, and we still don't have it.
Now, when you say anymore, you mean there used to be?
There did used to be. In Mel Carnahan, when Mel Carnahan was running for governor, we had a big ground game that came from the Democratic Party infrastructure, and he had a lot of emphasis on the Democratic Party, and we don't have that anymore, and we haven't had it for quite some time now, and a big part of that fell apart, of course, during we had the problem with the primary election in 2004, where we were very divisive when Claire McCaskill was running against Bob Holden,
the governor.
So, but if we go back to the support that Mel Carnahan had for a party infrastructure, that was the last time that we really had that. So if you don't have national money coming in and some kind of a get out the vote that is being run from something other than just igniting our what should be our infrastructure from the party, it's very difficult to get our votes out if we don't have that. And that's what happened in the election in 2010. In 2008, we had the Obama campaign running.
Yeah, because they were making a serious pitch in Missouri.
Correct.
And they stayed the whole time.
And they did
not.
Kerry's
campaign did not stay the
Correct.
Whole time in 2004.
And actually, I think that Obama's campaign in 2008 was actually the last one where there was a serious presidential spending.
Correct.
In the state. I know I get hammered by some of the operatives. Don't call me. I know about this. But I'm just saying that, that was the last big one was in 2008.
And again, and with no disrespect to Hillary Clinton's campaign, I covered 2008 election cycle along with Joe. No, there's no comparison between the Obama campaign then and the Hillary Clinton campaign now.
Oh, no. And so if you look back and you go, well, we had, we had this divisiveness in 2004, and then we were relying on the Kerry campaign for our big push at the end in our ground game and our field game.
And they had promised to stay.
And they had promised to stay.
This is one of my big stories,
Correct.
Is that the presidential debate Terry McAuliffe, who is now the governor of Virginia, who was then the DNC chair, was there with Dick Gephardt at a big press conference earlier in the day. And I asked him, because there were rumors that they were pulling out. And he said, no, we're serious. We're here to the end. We're serious on Missouri. And then it wasn't 24 hours later, I was getting calls from a particular key Democratic operative. But I got some calls from some who say, you might want to drive up to Lambert because they're all boarding
planes.
They're
all, and they did. And they, you know, we had many of our offices at the Monty Law Firm. We had these offices, and Jim and I individually owned all those offices so that we could donate them, you know, in-kind donations. And so we had people in all of our offices, and they just, you know, they just left the keys on the desk, basically. And so in 2004, we weren't able to then to pull it off, and Claire lost that governor's race. Now, because 2006 was the, you know, the swing back from...
Yeah. Well, and there was the Iraq War. There was all this.
There was the
backdrop.
And we had this Senate race. And, yes. And we really felt like we could win that.
And the stem cell.
And the stem cell. So we had... And we had minimum wage on the ballot, too. Yeah. We had a lot of things going on to drive turnout.
Huge amount of money that year. And it was a lot of Democratic money. And not a good Republican environment.
Right.
So that, again, that just goes to Joe's point. The national environment matters.
It does. It does. And so that's then, you know, where we had in 2008, and then, you know, not so much. And had we, by the time we got to 2010, we had, you know, we were relying on the fact that national money was going to come in for this Senate race, and it didn't happen. So when we didn't have that, then there was no ability to get out the vote. We could call up the Democratic Party, but they had never activated any of the local, you know, volunteers. We just didn't have anything. So the votes didn't turn out. And traditionally, we don't, just like you said, we don't get our voters out anyway. So we have to have an extra push to do it. And that's what happened in 2010. Now, I know that you say we got the benefit in 2012. Now, I happen to have lost that year, too, but I think that's a whole different story.
I was going to get to that because, in fact, I interviewed you at the time. Does Nixon talk to you since you talked to me? Because I did this story where you were really jabbing the governor, saying because he took all the money that was supposed to do that.
Well, he did. It is what it is. I do remember one of his staff people saying, now, Susan, you know, this could come down to a 7 or 8 point win for us. And so it's not close. And I said, what do you mean? 7 or 8 points is like a landslide.
But I mean, just so our listeners know, you were running for lieutenant governor in 2010.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't want this to be like a let's bash Jay Nixon show, but he does have kind of a reputation, even among Democrats, of not being particularly helpful in campaigns and somewhat selfish.
And to be honest, I never expected any help from anyone else who was on the ballot that year. And because I think everybody does need to run their own races. And had I not had a primary election, we would have had enough money. But because of the timing on that.
It was a weird primary election.
Yeah.
Because
there was like four candidates.
There were eight candidates.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about the serious ones.
No, I mean, but there were some former state reps there that I would consider, that did not get a lot of votes, that I would not consider unserious candidates. Like Fred Kratky, for example, came in last, but... You know, he was a state rep,
Truthfully, I had an 8-person primary. Every single one of the people in that primary had run for and been elected to something before.
Exactly. It wasn't a bunch of perennials.
No, it was very bizarre. And what happened is, I felt certain that I was going to win the primary. And in fact, I won the primary by a lot, like 30 points. So people wouldn't give me money and support early on because they said, we don't have to because we know you're going to win the primary and then we'll be there for you afterwards. And then we don't have to hurt anyone's feelings. Now, by the way, that whole hurt feelings thing's really bothered me because no one ever talks to male candidates about having hurt feelings. However, but what happens is that the time between the primary election,
which is in August, early August,
it's too short, and you can't If you have to go through the then approval process for the labor unions, for example, everything takes so long and you don't get your money until the end. And it became very difficult. And we saw that coming. We tried to guard against it, but
yeah. Because you ended up being, aside from Obama, I think you were the only Democrat who lost that was running statewide in 2012.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's
Now, to be fair to our guest,
don't want to hurt your feelings.
Oh no.
But to be fair to our guest, you were running against Peter Kinder, who had never lost an election before. He had run against serious candidates. I mean, Becky Cook is a serious candidate.
Oh, yeah.
Sam Page was a serious candidate. Yeah. And, you know, he used some pretty hard-edged tactics against you. I remember pretty clearly that he ran an ad criticizing you for being at a gay pride march in St. Louis. I think it was only aired in rural Missouri. And I brought this up to David Barklage, who was with Peter Kinder at the time. Because
he was a consultant.
And I asked him about it because Barklage was with Tom Schweik as well. And he wrote what I would consider a very heartfelt message of regret for a lot of things that he did after Tom Schweik died. And I brought this ad up because I was like, well, do you regret this particular moment in your career? Here's what he had to say about that.
When that ad came out, a lot of people in the gay community here in St. Louis were really upset about that. And you were with Peter Kinder then. Is that the type of ad that maybe you regretted, you know, sending or being a part with?
Well, I think that the purpose was sort of to point that her values in regards to issues and things were out of touch with rural Missouri. And, you know, I think the politics have changed in terms of gay issues, as we've seen, like on gun issues, it's gone decidedly pro-gun. I think on gay issues, it's gone decidedly the other way. So it wouldn't be used, one, because it wouldn't be very effective. And then, two, I think you always look back. I think you have a regret in a campaign of anything you say or do as negative. Because, guys, just like you, when you report a story that outs someone and destroys their career, I don't think you get up the next day gleefully. Now, maybe some do because they think they're going to go over, but I think most people, there is a regret to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that regret's the same. You do your job. Your candidate is the one that says, you know, yes or no in the pollster. But in the end of the day, you don't want to live your life or have your career where it's defined by one moment.
So that was a long clip, and I had to cut it off quickly because I rudely interrupted him after that. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, because I like David Barklage. I like Peter Kinder. I'm not trying to, like, you know, castigate him. But, I mean, that ad struck me as kind of a low blow against you in a way, and I felt like it needed a response. What's kind of your thought on that?
I agree with that. I now have got a lot tougher skin on a lot of things than I used to have in my youth, where I was all a little naive as to how this was going to go. And certainly every single campaign I've had has had at least one thing that I thought was pretty outrageous against me. And I thought this was, too. I just found it super offensive that, you know, that we would, you know, take the gay community and say, oh, we don't want to have any support and don't support this person. I don't know. In my opinion, if anybody didn't want to vote for me because I support gay rights, and that's fine. I support a lot of a lot more Democratic liberal causes than most of our Democratic candidates will admit to doing, and I always have. But I do think that it didn't have to be a negative campaign against me. It was clear, you know, even though Peter Kinder tried to say, oh, I didn't get much money at the end, Peter Kinder spent, you know, several million dollars in that race from the point where he was running in this primary election.
And just to point out, he was getting attacked pretty mercilessly by Brad Lager. You also ran attack ads against him. So I want to just mention that for fairness, but continue.
We did. But what happened is that the amount of money that Peter Kinder had to spend in order to shore back up his and reinforce his name ID was way out of proportion for how that race would have been with any other candidate in it. Because he was able to raise, you know, $3 to $4 million because he was running for governor. Then when he dropped back into the lieutenant governor's race, he had that money to spend. And so,
because it was statewide, listeners, they can't do it if you're running for Congress, but you can do it if you're running for statewide office.
So when you looked at it at the end of the day, Over the election cycle, Peter Kinder spent $4 million, right, and we only had one. So the negative ad maybe helped or hurt or didn't really matter.
But that probably
matter,
is a big... Are you kind of glad, though, in the end that you didn't have to be lieutenant governor and preside over the Senate a lot? I mean, let's be candid here. If you had won, the vast majority of your time over the last 4 years probably would have been presiding over the Senate and trying to basically wreak havoc on the Republican
which
majority.
Which is controlled heavily by Republicans.
I mean, are you kind of glad that you got to do other things besides that?
I did get to do other things. I went in that eyes open.
Yeah.
A part of why I said I would run for something like lieutenant governor, which, you know, everyone has talked about being kind of the ribbon cutter. And that's why I had a lot of people say, yeah, Susan, we love you, but we're not going to send you any money because we don't care who the lieutenant governor is. Peter Kinder hasn't caused any trouble the whole time he's been there. I said, well, I promise you, if you let me be lieutenant governor, I will cause all kinds of trouble. So you're right. I would have been sitting there causing trouble.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the end of the day, you look back and you go, really, would that be the way you want to live every day, is getting up and having to fight in that environment? And I think it's an incredibly awful environment right now in Jefferson City, and I'm a little disheartened by, you know, some of the things that they pass and do.
Now, how heavily are you involved in any, as far as supporting or helping to raise money or doing anything for any of the Democratic statewide candidates now? In the case of Lieutenant Governor, mm-hmm, it's Russ Carnahan, who is... And this time, Kinder is not running for re-election.
Yes.
And so...
It's against Mike Parson.
The Republican. So they're lesser known. I mean, mm-hmm, Russ Carnahan arguably has more name recognition, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Parson obviously is going to be hammering him on various issues. I'm just interested in how active you are in helping or hurting or raising money or doing whatever.
Over the last... last couple of months, I have shown up in Jefferson City and done some call time for the party. That's not going very well because people want to give to individual candidates.
This is interesting. Tell me about that.
Well, we actually, the party has largely been supported over the last year by Chris Koster writing checks directly to the party in order to keep the party doors open. He's been great about it. But the party really needs to move towards more sustainability on its own.
I mean, because at some point he needs to keep that money for him.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly, exactly.
Like now.
but it's really difficult to get people to give money directly to the party because they're not seeing that the party's doing anything. But the party itself, this is kind of what I alluded to, we need this infrastructure back. And so once we get past this election, I think it'll be the time, especially if we get campaign finance limits back in place. It'll make all the difference.
It'll
in the
make
world
the parties more influential.
Yeah. And the thing about it, I have never believed that the parties were only beneficial to throw money through. I really think that they're supposed to be the way that you're passing information to and from in your organizational structure. So I'm still a big fan of the party. So I'm doing things for the party. I have a building that I own in St. Joseph that I have Democratic headquarters running out of. And so I'm paying all the expenses associated with utilities and internet. And then I own the building. And so we've got people running there. I've done fundraisers for, I've done a couple of them for General Koster, and I did one for Russ Carnahan and mm-hmm. Jason Kander, and mm-hmm. I do those at my house. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing things. I can only do so much. I'll do anything anybody asks me to that I think will make a difference.
Well,
though.
I noticed because I think I'm Facebook friends with you. You shared my article today where I talked about how the Democrats in the legislature basically got crushed during veto session. And
yes.
I did notice that. And I mean, it didn't bring me a lot of joy to write,
to write
the Democrats are getting crushed. You know, just as if the Republicans were getting crushed, I wouldn't
enjoy
that.
Right, but that's
not
our job.
Exactly, mm-hmm. but it is what happened. Like it was not even very suspenseful as it was in previous years. It's because, in my opinion, the Democrats have lost incredible ground in the legislature, especially in rural parts of the state, which they used to dominate like in 2008 and 2006. The fact that there are no Democrats from Northeast Missouri anymore should be very alarming to Democrats statewide, I think. And in the legislature, I mean.
I agree.
Yeah.
And that's a part of the whole issue with what does the state party represent. Now people, they say, oh, why isn't the party doing anything? And there's this, it's like you picture the party as being this, you know, presence out there that is out doing stuff. And that's in reality, obviously, that's not the case. But we can't even recruit candidates to run for a bunch of these districts because there hasn't been any kind of support mechanism for them. And so we can go, the local people can say, hey, why don't you run for this state rep seat? But the Republicans are supporting their candidates with an organizational structure, and we don't have that in place.
Because one thing that is, again, this is one example, because I hear all the time from Democrats, they blame their legislative woes on quote-unquote gerrymandering. Now, I will not disagree with the fact that the map that came out after 2011 was not favorable to the Democrats in the House.
Yeah, but let's not get too
much into
that.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I found this year, there's a seat that includes Monroe County, Rawls County, and Pike County, which is now represented by a Republican. In 2006, there is no way a Republican would have won that seat. Right. A Democrat would probably be running for that seat unopposed. This year, there is not a Democrat running for the seat against the Republican incumbent. And that is replicated in multiple places where there used to be, that used to be Democratic, mm-hmm. up until 5 or 6 years ago. So
So now looking here at 2016, I mean, with what Jason just said in mind, there's been, in fact, by the time listeners hear this, hopefully I will have had my story on the website, which has to do with the Senate race, but a part of it is about the Trump effect, or the estimate, or what the GOP hopes will be the Trump effect, especially in rural Missouri and in the some of the outer suburbs, including Jefferson County, Lincoln County, I'm just using this, where they think that there are disgruntled blue-collar workers and maybe older people, and some of whom may have previously been Democrats, who like what Trump has to say, and they're hoping that that then translates to help the rest of their ticket. Roy Blunt, who's in a tight race with Jason Kander, and then on down, you know, we've got Eric Greitens running against Koster, and he's raising a lot of money, and so that one's getting nasty, and all down the line. So as you're looking at it from the outside, but being somebody who's hosting fundraisers, and plus your base, at least in St. Joe, I would think you would have at least a sense of whether or not there is much of a Trump effect as far as energy, because a lot of it's going to depend on turnout. I'm just curious what you're seeing.
Well, I'm not seeing the excitement level that would drive turnout, but for Trump supporters. Now, there are certainly... If you ask people, I'm not seeing like an organized wave that is getting people excited and then bringing other people into the fold to get out and help and volunteer. But I think it's probably because they just don't have any kind of field staff here doing that. If they were having functions, maybe there would be. We're not seeing that, at least not in the Northwest Missouri area. But there are a lot of disgruntled people. I think even if you look at the way our presidential primary went on the Democratic side, is that we still have a whole lot of people out there who are dissatisfied, and they are dissatisfied not in a way that went for Donald Trump, but dissatisfied in that they in a way that caused them to be for Bernie Sanders.
And so it
goes both ways. The number of people that I have run into in rural Missouri that were Sanders supporters makes me think if we'd been out there talking about liberal issues and we hadn't rolled over on everything liberal out in our rural areas, that we might actually have those people as Democrats again.
So are the Sanders people who you're talking to, are they going to vote for Hillary, or are they going to go third party just to show their?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I believe most of them will turn out and vote for Hillary Clinton. You know, it's easy to say. I look back to my youth where I was going to vote independent in the presidential election that John Anderson, which you won't know, but you would know,
yeah,
Joe.
I wasn't born.
When she's talking about you, she's
exactly.
talking about me.
Joe will know, but
yes,
you won't know that.
I was actually working.
But I'm a college student, and I'm thinking I'm an independent. I'm not just because I grew up in this Democratic family and it's all this. And when I went into the polls, I still voted for Jimmy Carter. So I think when it came down to it, I might have thought I was independent, but at the end of the day, I voted for the Democratic candidate. Not that it.
Although that was what 36 years ago.
But it's still this mindset, and things do change.
So does Clinton have much of an operation in your neck of the woods at all?
We have a pretty good Clinton operation going on in Kansas City. Not so much up in St. Joe. We have people there, but most of our people that are working out of headquarters are calling on behalf of the Koster campaign and putting out signs for Jason Kander. So we don't actually have any of the Hillary people there, but I anticipate that we will have.
So I mean, are you? I know the state Republican Party, you know, generally prides itself in being fairly organized. Are they having to take the place of the lack of a Trump operation? I know there is a Trump headquarters, and I know the two guys who are running it in Jeff City. But, you know, I've been hearing this, too. I mean, because there's just been an office recently that was opened for Trump in Fenton. And I had written something, and then I got a call from the Trump people saying, you need to emphasize, that's not us, that's volunteers.
Right.
So it's not, I mean, so these are volunteers who are doing it on their own.
Right. And so, and this is the whole question of infrastructure. When I talk about party infrastructure, I mean, do you have people who everyone in the county would know that they can call up and they're going to figure out how to get a sign or any of that? If you don't have visible people that are always there as your committee person or your ward person or whatever, I think it's even hard to organize a volunteer effort. But yeah, we're not seeing any kind of organized thing up where I am.
And, well, so what does that mean, do you think?
Well, I hope it means that they're not going to be able to generate a whole bunch of extra excitement and people going to the polls to vote Republican, that people won't see that it makes a difference or whether it does make a difference. And we don't know whether Missouri would make a difference or not. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're not on anyone's list of our state has to matter in the presidential race.
Yeah, I mean, just so our listeners know, we used to be a must-win. Well, we still are must-win
for Republicans,
but not for Democrats. And that can make a difference for states that are like that, because if one party is like, well, I don't need it, and they're not campaigning there, then the other party, even if they need it, as long as they think they're doing okay there, they're going to spend their money somewhere else, because there's no reason to spend it here when, let's say, they need to spend it in Ohio where it's competitive and where Ohio has been ground zero since 2004, frankly, in the presidential contest.
Now, I was thinking about this the other day because Joe mentions, and so do I, that in 2012, Mitt Romney won the state by 9 or 10 percentage points.
10 points.
But the trickle-down effect was nullified by the fact that Todd Akin imploded, Claire McCaskill did incredibly well, and that helped most of the ticket. I could be wrong. Today is September 16th, and if I am wrong about this, you can play this clip from here to the rest of the career.
Okay.
But having observed Roy Blunt and Eric Greitens, and you've known Roy Blunt longer than I have, I do not think that either one is going to make a Todd Akin-like disastrous comment. I could be wrong, but both of them are very disciplined when it comes to messaging. Some would say that they're over-disciplined.
Well, so, and that's why on the Democratic side, too, somewhat. I mean, Jason Kander, who is challenging Blunt, I mean, he may be somewhat lesser known, but he's really being active. His ad, the ad that's running now, has gotten national attention. And of course, you've got Koster, who also, has been working really hard. And I do want to mention one thing. All these candidates, regardless of party, people seem to forget, if you're based in Jeff City, candidates based in Jeff City who are a big shot in Jeff City seem to think they're big shots in the rest of the state. The state political history is littered with people who are big shots in Jeff City and lost statewide. I just want to mention
But here's the reason I mentioned that part. Like, if Trump ends up winning the state similarly to Romney did, and we don't know if that's going to happen, but if it does, and you don't have a variable like what happened in 12, shouldn't that be a cause of concern for the rest of the Democratic ticket, essentially?
You know, and yes, I think that's true, because with the exception of Attorney General Koster, because I think that Koster has a unique niche that he has carved out of voters. He's going to get all of the Democratic support. Any Democrats, even if we don't have good turnout, they're going to turn out and they're going to vote for him. But he has coalesced a large group of Republican voters that traditionally would vote Republican in his endorsement by the Farm Bureau and the NRA. And so when people who are independents look at all of that, he has a tendency, I think, to take those people as well.
Yeah, because the Farm Bureau has that ad with the Farm Bureau.
But I did want to talk about that from a policy standpoint. We talked a little bit about this before the show. And I don't know, again, how that's going to play out politically. But from somebody who studies rural Missouri and policies there for a long time, him getting all the endorsements of these agricultural commodity groups like the Farm Bureau or the pork producers is a really significant moment in the policy history of the Democratic Party, because for a long time, you know, Democrats kind of clashed with those commodity groups. They thought that they were like too tied to big agriculture or big ag policy. Now you have a gubernatorial candidate that's basically embracing that type of thing and a legislature that also agrees. So isn't that going to have a pretty monumental effect on agriculture policy if he wins, basically?
Yeah, I think it will. And I think that for the most part, a lot of people don't understand that. One of the things that's so interesting about this, you know, from the party switch standpoint is, you know, when Chris Koster switched parties, he didn't switch any of his policies. He had the same—
Except abortion.
Well, except for he wasn't—it was almost like— It didn't matter that much. That's probably not the right way to say it. He didn't have a strong stance one way or another on choice. However, the thing that did make a difference was the stem cell, which is closely aligned to it.
But continue your other
correct.
Point, yes.
So with the exception of he said, you know, he had said choice. I mean, I hate to say that since it's a strong issue for me, but he never come out as strongly one way or another on choice, but he did on stem cell, which put him clearly.
You're 100% right. And this is something that I think has been really underlooked by a lot of people, that when he did switch parties, he didn't change a lot of his policy views on things. Like up until a month ago, he was opposed to campaign contribution limits, and he now is for them.
Well, I wouldn't say a month ago, maybe 2 months ago.
But I'm saying,
I'm
agreeing with your point.
Yeah. So he didn't shift. That's the thing that was that struck me as odd about Eric Greitens. So Eric Greitens, up until he decided to run, said he was, you know, he was a Democrat, and he went to Democratic things. When he said, "I'm a Republican," he says, "Therefore, here's my positions," and they were all Republican issues. There wasn't a single position that he said that he believed that would have put him ever in the Democratic camp. So I don't know where he actually stands.
Well, although to be fair, on gay when it comes to gay rights issues, Greitens has been a bit more moderate on that because there was some
the SJR thing.
Some exchange and stuff going on,
was a business thing. That was because the businesses were all it wasn't as if he was championing something.
But I have heard that before, that some of Greitens' critics just they don't believe that somebody could be a Democrat and then adopt all the Republican positions. Whereas even if you don't like the fact that Chris Koster is more conservative on things, at least you could point back to, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago and point to some consistency there.
Correct. And that's what I'm saying. If you have these people, you know, it's like a big Venn diagram. You got your Democrats that all believe in your Republicans, and you got this center area in where they overlap, and that's where you ought to find your moderate Republicans and your moderate Democrats. And you couldn't tell who's a Democrat or who's a Republican. And Chris Koster was one of those guys because he had these conservative things, but he also had union support and the trial lawyer support. So he was always in that middle area.
But to be fair to Greitens, you know, I think he's also a very attractive candidate. He beat 3 very tough opponents in a primary. I've noticed like his campaign is very aggressive and very responsive. Whenever he's criticized, they have an ad on TV like the next day.
Yeah, they're very disciplined.
So I think he's very formidable, and I think that he is getting like a lot of legitimate, very passionate support among a lot of people. So how does Koster combat with something like that?
And I agree with all those things, but I guess where I'm saying is my problem with this whole thing is I really don't know his policy position on anything. I mean, what you say you're going to do versus what you are going to do and what you have done in the past. And he's never been in any kind of position where you know how he's going to govern, because he has no experience whatsoever in any kind of governmental setting. He may be a smart guy, which I'm sure he is, but because of this whole thing where he has never taken any, he didn't take any positions as a Democrat, and he's adopted all Republican ones. I don't know. He may, if he would be elected, become way more to the left than the Republicans would expect.
But shifting back to Koster again, okay, I was there for the veto session. The Republicans were hammering at the Democrats, especially in the photo ID debate over the implementation bill, which the governor vetoed, and it was overridden in the House and Senate. But the Republicans, especially in the House, were hammering, saying, well, Koster has said he's fine with this bill. He finds it as a fine compromise. And I confirmed that with his campaign, that was his stance. Well, and then on the gun bill, Ron Richard, who's the head of the Senate, said in his closing remarks after the override vote in the Senate, and everything's at the end, he's like, well, Koster said that he would have signed it.
Yeah.
So my point being that where he may have carved this middle ground, but there was a lot of Democrats who were had their limb. They were on a limb.
They were undercut, basically.
And they were undercut. And let's say he wins, okay?
Correct.
Okay, let's say he becomes governor. He's going to have all these Democratic legislators, some of whom may still be a little ticked off over that because they don't, especially urban Democrats, they may be a little concerned about his views on, let's say, now he has said he's against the constitutional amendment for photo ID. So if that manages to fail, then that argument, people will just forget about that. But the gun thing in particular, which has really become, you know, very touchy for Democrats, I could see where there could be some ill will there.
I agree with that. And I think clearly General Koster has a position on guns that is not down the line of the Democratic Party. It's not down mine. And I come from a family. Everyone has guns. We all have guns. Everybody takes it for granted that people have guns. You know, the women in my family have been in law enforcement. I think it's kind of fun. My sister and my sister-in-law, the women. So we have guns. But we also believe that there can be reasonable restrictions on who gets a gun, mm-hmm. and that you shouldn't have to worry about
training.
Exactly.
That ended up being a big issue.
I think so. And I think if you can't pass a background check, then you probably shouldn't have a gun. And who can't pass one? Well, somebody who probably shouldn't have a gun.
I'm glad you mentioned background checks, because you were alluding to that ad that Jason Kander did. And, you know, I've talked all often on the show about, you know, sometimes Democrats hide from typically Democratic positions. You got to give Jason Kander credit for basically saying, I'm for background checks. I'm for this solidly Democratic position that may not be super popular in a very creative way.
But, yeah, I mean, he's just so our listeners know, he's blindfolded while he puts together an assault weapon.
Yeah, but from a messaging standpoint, I know that Chris Koster and Jason Kander are two separate people running two separate campaigns, but they are kind of linked somewhat politically in their fates.
But their positions are different.
But their positions are different, mm-hmm. and he's basically making the argument, and I know a lot of his supporters are, I mean Jason Kander, that Roy Blunt is too close to the NRA, and that's a bad thing. Whereas Koster is with the NRA, and I don't know how you can criticize Roy Blunt for being, you know, too close to the NRA, and then be happy when Chris Koster gets the NRA endorsement. I'm not talking about Democrats in
correct.
General.
Yeah, but that's right. But Kander in this position, I think he's doing it, and I'm not defending him, but just saying tactically, Blunt got the NRA endorsement, and the NRA is running attack ads on Kander, which is a difference.
And that is
which
not,
it was a difference. Now, the NRA is not running attack ads against Greitens, even though they endorse
Koster. Yeah, and that observation was by no means a criticism of Jason Kander, by the way. It's more of just a sentiment observation, but continue.
No, but I think that's true. I know that I'm solidly a Democrat, which doesn't mean that I have the exact same position on all the Democratic issues that all the rest of the Democrats do either, because I come from a background that is a lot more conservative fiscally, and you know, I'm a 30-year CPA, and I look at things and monetary things in a much more narrow view. And so there's a lot of budgetary things that I haven't agreed with the Democrats on. But we as Democrats have always been a little more broad in accepting people who we say, I know that, you know, I've known an awful lot of pro-life Democrats, and we differ on this issue. But overall, we have the same general views if you package them all up. And we try to get along. And we try not to talk about the one issue that we don't agree on. And I think that's what we're seeing here. There's a lot of people I know that are unhappy with Democrats that are unhappy with Chris Koster because of his ag policy. Now, they have to be the people that are actually living in the rural areas so they understand ag policy, which the majority of the Democrats in the city don't. So,
right.
And what you're saying is absolutely true. If Chris Koster is the governor, knowing his position on ag policy, we're going to have a whole monumental shift.
Even different from Nixon.
Correct.
Because Nixon, I think, was closer to the traditional Democratic on ag policy, which was a little bit more skeptical of the big business.
But on the other hand, Nixon, I would say, is more pro-ag than some of the urban Democrats.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right.
But not as much as Koster. I mean, it's a continuing shift if he becomes governor.
Right.
But you have some things that, you know, that like the couple of bills that would affect our civil justice system, they did not get overridden. There's a more of a middle area there. So the collateral source and the expert witness stuff, those things are still, you know, the same laws there. So you get some things that you get a hard push because the Chamber of Commerce pushes hard. But at the end of the day, people will see two different sides on those types of issues. And so I guess it comes down to which is the one issue that is most important to you and if you can agree with somebody on it or not. And for most of our Democrats, the one issue, if it is ag policy, then they're going to have a problem with a choice between these two guys, the traditional Democrat who would have their back and now doesn't, versus somebody who's a Republican who is probably never going to have their back either.
So my final question for you, it's the same question I asked Sarah Steelman. Will you ever run for anything again?
You know, I don't know. I really have enjoyed not running this year. It's been great. Although, like I said, I've done some call time, so I'm still out there doing some things. So I never say never, but it's not in my plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you ever have dreams of being lieutenant governor again, if Mike Carson wins.
I'm not going to dream of being lieutenant governor again. Well, that one came and went.
Well, with all due respect to previous lieutenant governors, you do sometimes have a lot of time on your hands, depending on the situation. We want to thank you for coming to St. Louis. This has been great. We always appreciate talking with you. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JMANNIES.
And how would we follow you on social media, if at all?
Yeah, no, I'm there. I'm there. It's Susan Monty. And I still have my website, and I still do a few things out there. So you can still find me.
Check her out on social media. We'll be back next time. Until then, so long.